With the launch of a new podcast, there's another way to listen to The Sun, called The Wait. It joins reporter Yvonne Wenger on her long and unconventional journey to motherhood.
You know, you come back to it when you're sitting in the doctor's office and they show you an x-ray that shows that you would have to go through major kind of scientific advanced procedures to carry a child, when what feels more natural is becoming a mother to the child who needs one.
A challenging diagnosis after years of unsuccessful pregnancy attempts led Yvonne to look into adoption and foster parenting. What she found and didn't find, and the unexpected place she ended up, motivated her to do something rare in journalism: become part of the story.
This is a story about the children in our city who need adults to step up for them, put their hearts on the line for them, fight for them, love them, nurture them. It's a story about the ones who go back home and the ones who stay.
The Wait is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Yvonne's story is also being told through words, pictures, and video on our website. Go to baltimoresun.com/thewait.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
Nearly 40 years ago, his classmates planted a tree in memory of Alan Tremakis at the corner of Wolf and Monument Streets, in the midst of the sprawling Johns Hopkins Hospital complex in East Baltimore. A medical student, Tremakis specialized in internal medicine. He wanted to be a cardiologist. He had been Phi Beta Kappa at Columbia, and Hopkins ranked him in the top quarter of his class. He was 25 years old, just a few months from graduating, when he was killed, the victim of a mugging and senseless shooting on a winter night. I have a memory of Tremakis' white medical coat draped over a wooden chair at the prosecutor's table in Baltimore Circuit Court. That was during the trial of the accused killer, a teenager named James Featherstone. About 6:30 p.m. on January 15, 1979, Alan Tremakis came out of a building at Hopkins and walked toward his car on East Monument Street. He never got to it, interrupted on the way by three teenage boys who police at the time believed were after money. Tremakis started running. One of the boys had a handgun. He shot Alan Tremakis in the back as he fled. Tremakis died in the Hopkins emergency room, an incomprehensible waste of a promising life. I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun, and this is the Roughly Speaking podcast, episode 447. Today, we hear from James Featherstone. He was 17 when he was sentenced to life in prison, the only person convicted in connection with the death of Alan Tremakis. In the 36th year of his sentence, James Featherstone became eligible for release because of what is known now as the Unger ruling. 6 years ago, the Maryland Court of Appeals found a serious flaw in the instructions judges had given juries in trials prior to 1980 of Featherstone and dozens of other defendants. Since then, more than 180 of those men, their average age 64, have been released from prison. James Featherstone stepped back into freedom in the summer of 2014 when he was 52 years old. 1979 was my first year as a columnist for the Sun Papers of Baltimore, in a column that I wrote for the Evening Sun during Featherstone's trial in November 1979. I noted the presence in the courtroom of Carol Healy, a nurse, graduate student at the University of Maryland, and Alan Tremakis' fiance. In the years since Tremakis' death, Carol Healy became Carol Klassen and moved to Texas. She has since become a friend of James Featherstone, and that's part of today's story. When I first contacted her to get comments about the Unger ruling and Featherstone's expected release, Carol Klassen said she was appalled. Not that Featherstone might be released, but that he was still in prison. She cited two reasons: Featherstone's young age at the time of the crime, and her belief that another teenager actually pulled the trigger on the gun that was used in the killing, but never recovered. Prosecutors had difficulty getting definitive and consistent testimony from two teenage witnesses during the trial. Carol Klassen told me she had worked as a stress management therapist and a biofeedback specialist. And in that role, she counseled families of murder and suicide victims and people suffering from panic attacks. But never in my life, she said, did I see two young boys so frightened as they changed their story. Still, prosecutors secured a conviction of James Featherstone. On the day of his sentencing, Featherstone told Judge Martin B. Greenfeld, "I have done wrong before in my days, but I never killed anybody. I'm innocent, Your Honor." Greenfeld sentenced him to life in prison. Featherstone was 17 at the time. Over the last several months, I've been in touch with James Featherstone and Carol Klassen. Today, we'll hear what life on the outside has been like for Featherstone, and I'll share some of the emails I received about him from Carol Klassen. 4 years into his new life, James Featherstone has found, in stretches of weeks and sometimes months, work as a laborer. But he continues the hunt for a full-time job. He attends monthly meetings of Unger inmates. He stays on top of the news. He talks about politics and crime in Baltimore, the city's no-snitching culture, the amount of guns in the city, Mayor Catherine Pugh and the man she recently nominated to become the next police commissioner. He has views on police and mass incarceration. And James Featherstone has started to talk to boys in trouble. He wants to form a nonprofit, RISE is what he calls it, that will be focused on training boys and young men in DJ arts and culinary skills as a way to keep them from lives of crime and failure. I found James Featherstone one day recently in front of the two-story row house he rents with the help of Section 8 vouchers. He was raking up leaves and windblown trash on the small patch of grass in front of the house. We're at Kenyon in Minnesota in northeast Baltimore. Outside of James' house, he's raking up and trying to keep track of some of the trash that blew down here. It was windy the last couple days, huh?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Very windy. How you doing?
Good, James.
How are you doing? That's the question.
I'm blessed. I'm blessed and grateful. So I try not to complain. Whatever problems I have are better than the ones that I have, so I'm grateful.
How long have you been living here now on Kenyon Avenue?
February be 2 years. 2 years. Not a bad neighborhood. Good block. You know, I always lived in East Baltimore all my life. You know, so I got a nice little block, though.
All your life before prison time, right?
Yes, yes. All my life before prison time. It's convenient. I'm trying to get the community to boycott the store behind us.
Well, what's up with the store behind you?
He's disrespectful. He overcharges the community. He bought half of the kids that live in here out of his store. He talks to them like, you know, like they trash. And I got a problem when you spending your money and you getting talked to in a certain manner.
What is it, a convenience store?
Yes. I don't go there. I walk to the store up the street. There's one up at the other corner. So that's the one that I tend to go to. Because, like I said, I got a problem with I'm spending my money with you and you talking to me. He won't even let them go for a penny. They spend their money in there every day. If they come in there and hear a penny short, he turns them away. Yeah. And as long as that you continue to do business with him, he's going to continue to treat you like that because he's beginning to think that it's acceptable. And it is because you're still spending your money with him.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, I don't want to keep you from doing your work here. It's interesting to see you outside here cleaning up.
I should have been had this done. Yeah, but most days.
Well, wait a minute. If you tried to rake the leaves the last couple of days, they would have blown all over the place anyway, right?
Yeah, but it should have been done before then. One of my problems, you know. But life's been good, though. Oh, man. Glad I got a yard to rake. I ain't never think I would have one of these, so.
It's a little piece of green here, right? Yeah. It's a little chilly.
Yeah, I'm going to take you inside.
All right, he's going to finish raking up here, and then we're going to talk. Sure. your release was 4 years ago. Just tell us where you went to live immediately and then up until 2 years ago when you came here.
Okay, immediately upon release, I went and lived in the transitional house up on Park Avenue. Stayed there for a year. Then I went to live with my brother for a year. Then I went out on my own and lived on Oliver Street. And then I moved here. I'm blessed. And the aspect of being supportive, my whole family, and I have some good friends and people who's been reaching out to really try to help me be successful.
In the time you've been out, now it's been 4 years, what would you say was the strangest thing that you've encountered about life in Baltimore, life on the outside? Something you didn't expect or you just took a while to get used to?
Wow, that's a real loaded question because there's a lot of things. But the most striking thing to me since I've been home is the conditions of the black community. It is so sad. I never thought that I would see that it reach a point in which that it is. I mean, and just the world in general, as it's turning out to be now.
In what way would you say it's worse than it was when you went in? You're just talking about the black community. Let's start with that.
The whole structure is no love, there's no unity, there's no communities. When I left, it was communities. You know, as individuals, it's so me-rism. You know, everybody about me, and that we looked out for our communities. We looked out for our neighborhood.
You don't think that's happening now? What makes you say that now?
Because of the things that's going on in the communities. Let's just take, for example, you know, these recent shootings with these kids getting hit in the crossfire. When I was growing up, that didn't happen. People still got killed. But dudes went and got who they killed. They didn't get all these innocent people in between things.
Well, you're talking about the 1970s, right? There were more people living in Baltimore then, maybe 100,000 more people, and not as many killings per capita as we've had the last 3 years. I mean, since you've been out of prison, things have gotten worse. Actually, things were a little better before 2015. The last 3 years have been really rough, really violent, and it's been hard for the police or anybody to get control of it.
First of all, that's going to be very hard for any one agency to do because the problems that's going on in Baltimore is bigger than the police agency, is bigger than the mayor's office. You know, you need the whole city of Baltimore to come together and get a grip on this if you really want to get a grip on it. First of all, with the police department, that you got to understand that it's zero trust in the black community with the Baltimore City Police Department. So the first thing, I mean, that she just appointed a new police commissioner. And, you know, so my suggestion would be, I mean, you need to revamp your whole system and start over again and try to find ways to establish some trust in your communities.
Last time I talked to you, you said you were interested in doing something with kids. With young people, young men especially. Have you thought some more about that?
Well, I'm still doing it. Actually, in the process of getting a 501c and got a program that's called Rise. We just recently went to, and I'm very excited that we was invited into the Maryland Training School for Boys, and that went real well.
Where did you go this time?
The Hickey School for Boys. And actually, I was surprised, the same Hickey School that when I was a little boy that I went to. It was interesting. You know, first thing I noticed that how much it has changed from when I went there. It's actually now a prison, you know. And going inside there and talking with them, and what we did was that we didn't just talk to them. We didn't just go in there and just share our stories. We interact with them and listen to theirs. And, you know, and one of the things that I learned that they want help. You know, a lot of them are cries for help. You know, that they have no one to talk to, no one to believe in them. And a lot of them just act out on emotion. I know because I did that as when I was a kid. That's how I responded, you know, so.
What did you talk to them about? Did you tell them your story?
Yes, I shared my story with him that I've been locked up for 35 years, 6 months, and 5 days. I shared with him the fact that while I was in prison, that my mother was killed, that my nephew stabbed my mother 13 times with a butcher knife, that a year after that, that my father died from cancer. 2 years after that, my best friend, my brother, Jerome Featherstone, was killed in a car accident. Me and my brother was very close. What's crazy about his death was the day before he died, he came to visit me. He brought his daughter and brought her because she said she wanted to see me. She said that I was the only person in the family that listened to her objectively. And we sat there and had a wonderful visit. The next day, they told me to call home. He was dead. Coming home from work, he was working for Homeland Security, and he hit a patch of black ice and slid into a parked snowplow.
Jerome Featherstone Sr. was a veteran of the Marines, the married father of three, and a respected junior league wrestling coach who steered several boys away from the call of the streets. He died in January 2004. He was 43 years old. What was the hardest adjustment being on the outside? Was it finding work?
That's still my hardest adjustment is finding work. Finding work, housing, transportation. I mean, these are the things that...
Yeah, but you found a place to live.
Right.
And transportation is getting around on a bus, right?
Right.
But you told me the toughest thing was work because you could only find temporary jobs.
Right. And that's what I'm doing right now as we speak. That's why we used to be able to sit here today and got the kind of time that we had, because that actually would be a nice job if it was consistent.
What's the job, the temporary job?
Basically, what you do is just go around and be a laborer, go around cleaning up or sweeping up or moving.
On construction sites?
Right, construction sites, schools, I mean, different places, different locations, different things. And I mean, that's okay. You know, it pays the bills if it was consistent.
But it's not consistent. I mean, it's not like 5 days a week.
No, I mean, it may be for 5 months. But then you may not work for another three. Like now, since I had my trip to Texas, I worked it one day. And I went to Texas September. I came back from Texas September 29th. I worked it one day.
So have you tried to find full-time work? I mean, skip the temp agency and go right to an employer?
Well, actually, I'm doing that now. I'm praying that I get a call from Gon Denzel now, you know, to work up there, to be a house manager and to work with the guys transitioning from drug use to back into the community.
God, Denzi is a treatment center.
Right.
Okay. So you'd like a job like that. If someone's listening here and they might have a job for you, James, what else are you interested in doing?
Well, my passion is, like I say, what I'm going to do is that I love working with kids and trying to save some of these kids' lives, because we're losing them at an alarming rate and for no reason. And that when you look at the kids that you see on TV at them college games and all that stuff, and the kids in these neighborhoods, and you sit back and you wonder, what's the difference? Why are they so successful and they are not? And I would say that opportunities and what you are exposed to.
Also, supportive family, right, or a mentor or somebody who took an interest in you, right?
Right. I mean, you need, and like with my program, Rise, that I'm very excited that I have recruited a professional DJ who want to start a DJ school. Not just teach him DJ, but teach him the whole art of being, you know, the whole history of DJing, teach him how to build robots. You know, I got a guy that's willing to come in that's going to teach him how to be culinary arts, how to bake. So, I mean, I have some programs along with just teaching them life skills.
Do you have some help with this nonprofit? I mean, is somebody helping you organize it?
I mean, I have a team. I have, you know, a few guys that I was incarcerated with. I have Daphne, who was moms of murdered sons. You know, I have a few people who've never been incarcerated who just want to see changes in the community, just encouraging me and helping me, because I get frustrated. I get frustrated because I know that I have some good ideas, and I know that I know what worked for me. And that's what I can employ and help try to save some other lives. And everybody seems like Don't nobody want to deal with guys that's been incarcerated. And for real, that these are the guys that can save. You know, these are the ones that these kids going to listen to.
In 1986, after James Featherstone had been in prison for about 7 years, he heard from Carol Klassen, who, as Carol Healy back in Baltimore, had been engaged to marry Alan Tremakis, the man Featherstone had been convicted of killing. So this is an interesting thing that developed. Carol Klassen. Carol Klassen was the woman who was engaged to Alan, and you connected with her over the years while you were in prison and then since you got out, right?
Yes.
You've become friends with her. Can you talk about that a little bit? Some people will wonder, well, wait a minute, he was convicted of killing her fiancé, and yet she's reached out to him. They've actually went on a couple of trips together. You've become friends.
Yes, actually, she's a part of... helping me establish Rise and helping me build it, you know, because she, you know, as you know, she's a professional PhD, and that was her work. I didn't know none of this.
How did it start? Did it start with letters in prison?
Well, I met Carol when I was going to trial. That's the first time I seen her. And the first conversation we ever had, was the first words she ever said to me was, "I hate you." And I didn't think nothing of it, you know. Criminal trial going on and emotions high. So I was, in 1986, I received a letter. It was in December, right before Christmas, you know, about December the 22nd. I received a letter, and in that letter she stated that she forgive me, and that she stated what she said in the courtroom, that she hated me and that she forgive me. And wow, man.
Did you ever say to her, "I didn't do it"?
No, no.
But you maintain that you didn't do it.
Yes. Actually, she said to me that she know I didn't do it, or that they didn't produce the evidence to convict me, you know. And so she felt that I was the scapegoat, which I still feel.
Emailed letters I received from Carol Klassen address a lot of things. I'll read first her remarks about Alan Tremakis, and then why, years later, she reached out to James Featherstone. Of Alan, she wrote, "He was kind, gentle, and compassionate, and went out of his way to help others. He cared deeply for the well-being of his patients. He was serious and dedicated to his studies. In my mind's eye, I can see the boyish, handsome young man with strands of light chestnut hair falling across his forehead, as he diligently takes notes and underlines in his textbooks. He is the eternal boy man who I will love for eternity." Now here's where she explained her desire to contact Featherstone in prison. "In 1986, I was haunted by the image of a bewildered and scared boy who was standing trial for a high-profile murder. When I wrote to James, I did not believe he pulled the trigger. I stated I was sorry for saying I had hated him during the trial. I was asking for forgiveness in addition to extending forgiveness if there was any involvement in the murder case. But I firmly believed in James's innocence." Featherstone maintains that he was there the night of the mugging and shooting, but that he did not fire the fatal shot.
"I remember in our last conversation when you asked me how did I feel about that shooting that took place and that girl and the kid that got shot, and the girl wouldn't tell who was shot, child."
That was out on Edmondson Avenue.
We begin with the story of a little girl who was shot in the backseat of a car in southwest Baltimore.
Homicide detectives spent the day canvassing the crime scene, handing out flyers and putting up posters, all in an effort to find the person responsible for critically wounding 7-year-old Taylor Hayes.
That little girl, whose name is Taylor, is here at Shock Trauma this morning in critical and unstable condition. Now, we're told this shooting happened yesterday afternoon around 2:30 on Lyndhurst Street in southwest Baltimore. Police say someone shot into a blue Honda and struck
one of the guns used in the exchange was found in Taylor's car, driven by 33-year-old Darnell Holmes. Holmes faces handgun and drug charges. Police don't know if Holmes was the target or even if she actually fired the gun. She is not cooperating.
"You had asked me about that, and I told you then, and I maintain that now, that when you out there and you living in that lifestyle, that those are rules to that game. And those are the rules. If you're in there and you're in it, that you play by, you don't tell.
So you didn't tell the police who you thought shot Alan Tremakis?
No, I didn't tell them anything.
Did you tell all this to Carol, or did she? She said she forgave you and she actually believed you?
Yes. Well, I mean, and she said that the evidence supported that, and that, like she said, that at during the time of my arrest, that people didn't believe what police would do. You know, it's beginning to come to light now, and like the kid got on the stand and said the police made him say it was me. But, you know, I mean, he was scared. I was scared. I was 16 years old fighting for my life, so I was afraid too.
In another email I received from Carol Klassen, she recalled reaching out to Featherstone a few years after his release. She was in Texas by then and able to connect by telephone. James, she said, called while I was cycling on St. Patrick's Day on a bike trail.
She let me know that it was on St. Patrick's Day because when she stopped on the bike trail, she found the horseshoe. And she took a picture of it and sent me. Carol has become, wow, one of my best friends in life. And it amazes me to how far our relationship has grown.
You have taken some trips together. You went to New York with her. She treated you to see actually New York City, which you had never seen before.
Actually, since we met, she has flew down here, and we spent a week down here together. You know, we took a trip to New York City, which I never went before, and saying some things. And I was invited to her home in Dallas, which is beautiful. Wow, I still sit here and wonder about. Actually, she sent me a picture last night of the sunset, because in her backyard is a 250-acre lake. And I would just every day, the whole time I was in Texas, every morning when they would wake up and come downstairs, I'd be sitting out on a deck on the sun looking at the beach.
If it hadn't been for the Unger ruling, do you think you'd still be in prison?
If it wasn't for the Unger ruling, I would have died in prison. The Unger ruling came from the heavens. You know, it did. You know, that this is a blessing that my mother, my brother, this is their prayer. During that time, I ain't even have sense enough to pray for myself. I had given up.
There was good reason for that. In 1989, when the public learned that a convicted police killer named Robert Daley Angel was getting unsupervised weekend furloughs from Maryland's Patuxent Institution, the governor at the time, William Donald Schaefer, shut the program down. The controversy followed the 1988 presidential campaign of George H.W. Bush, whose opponent that year was Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. Bush's infamous campaign ads exploited the unsupervised furloughs of Willie Horton, a prisoner who fled Massachusetts and attacked a Maryland couple. Years later, another Maryland governor, Paris Glendening, like Schaefer, a Democrat, put a stop to the possibility of parole for lifers like James Featherstone. At this point, when I was speaking to Featherstone, I thought of the scene in The Shawshank Redemption when the inmate named Red, played by Morgan Freeman, goes before the parole board after 40 years in prison.
Ellis Boyd Redding, if I'll say you've served 40 years of a life sentence, you feel you've been rehabilitated?
Rehabilitated? You know, I don't have any idea what that means.
Well, it means you're ready to rejoin society.
I know what you think it means, Sonny. To me, it's just a made-up word, a politician's word, so that young fellas like yourself can wear a suit and a tie and have a job. What do you really want to know? Am I sorry for what I did?
Well, I am.
There's not a day goes by I don't feel regret. Not because I'm in here, because you think I should. I look back on the way I was then. A young, stupid kid who committed that terrible crime. I want to talk to him. I want to try to talk some sense to him. Tell him the way things are. But I can't. That kid's long gone, and this old man is all that's left. I gotta live with that. Rehabilitated? It's just a bullshit word. So you go on and stamp your form, Sonny, and stop wasting my time. Because to tell you the truth, I don't give a shit.
James Featherstone says Shawshank is one of his favorite movies. But unlike Red, he never expected to have his file stamped approved for parole. It was the Unger case, the ruling by the Maryland Court of Appeals, that made him eligible for release.
You know, and what the Unger ruling not only did for us, the guys, all the guys that got out on Unger, but it created hope and other lifers that still are in prison to serve in life that they may can have a chance too.
Did you ever go up for parole? And if you did, what were the hearings like for you?
In 1988, I was coming out. I was in the Patuxent program. So in 1988, I was coming out on leave. Well, I've been out of prison. I left the prison 6 times.
You were getting work release?
No, I was getting day leaves, getting ready to be integrated into work release. This was how they release you. It was a system.
And that's when they shut it down.
That was Robert Angel. Montgomery County found out that he was out with triple life, with 12 years and on for killing a couple polices, and that was it. They closed down the whole program.
Yeah, and then governors after that refused to release lifers, even if they were recommended for parole.
Right.
So when you went to a parole hearing, was that a good experience for you? Did it give you some hope?
Well, I went to one.
Just one?
And the only reason I went to one, I went to my first one. And at my first parole hearing, I received a 5-year set off with a recommendation that I be inside the CAM system. I had 16 years in. However, right after I went up for parole, Governor Glenn Denny got on TV and said that life mean life. And though they never put it in writing, it was always implemented in policy. You know, so they was giving guys that got in 20 years, and 25 years set off. So I don't know if I could have took all that in at one time, so I just never went. I always knew that unless I got a lawyer and got out of prison, escape, or God intervened and helped me, I was going to die in prison.
You gave up.
Yes.
But the Unger ruling opened the door. In July 2014, Featherstone went back to circuit court in Baltimore, and before a judge reduced his life sentence to the 35 years he had served, Featherstone listened to Alan Tremakis' sister, Rita Kohlberg, and a Hopkins administrator speak about the loss of the promising medical student. Mary Foy, associate dean and registrar of the medical school, said, "We can never know what lives were lost because Alan was not there to treat them, or what discoveries were not made because he was not there to find them." In court that day, Featherstone thanked the judge for a second opportunity, signed some papers, and, accompanied by University of Maryland law and social work students, left the courtroom to start a new life. 4 years later, at age 56, about to turn 57, he's still looking for a full-time job.
I mean, it's frustrating. One, because I'm one of the few guys that's going you're going to see to get out of prison. That, you know, you see a lot of people look for the system that to take care of them. I'm going to be one of the few guys you see that look for the day when I don't need the system for anything.
Well, they're also a little older than you, too. You're on the younger side of the Ungers. And some of those guys, you know, if they had lived their full life outside of prison, might have retired by now. You're still working age.
Yes. Well, I probably would have been retired too because I got a cousin that when I went to prison, he went to Marines. You know, he graduated from high school and went to Marines, and now, wow. You know, so he done retired from Marines.
Oh, so you think you would have gone into the service?
It would have been a likely, you know, option because my brother went.
Yeah.
That's what made my cousin go. And all three of us, we grew up together. And, you know, I mean, because that I had scholarships for wrestling for every high school in Baltimore City wanted me, you know, that I was, you know, great at wrestling, you know. And that's why I be trying to tell so many of these kids that we throw our life away for nothing. I think about the Priory Hall thing all the time. That is just a tragedy all the way around.
All four suspects, according to Baltimore County Police, are now in custody. One of them has been named. He is 16-year-old Donta Harris. He has been charged as an adult. We also have been told the name of the officer, the female officer who was killed. We believe she was hit by a vehicle and run over. She was a four-year veteran. Her name, Amy Caprio. Officer Amy Caprio lost her life yesterday.
The assistant state's attorney described the last moments of Officer Caprio's life, how she stood down Harris in a Jeep, her gun drawn, yelling commands, he accelerating purposefully, striking and killing the young officer as she fired one shot. Between that and Harris's lengthy juvenile record of stealing cars, the judge denied bail for the city ninth grader.
A 16-year-old has been charged as an adult. The name is Donta Harris. That Donta Harris is being held without bail. All of this information is coming to us from court records.
The three other teens you mentioned records. In this case have yet to be charged at this hour. We're told the Baltimore County Police Department expects to charge them later this evening.
All four of them kids is getting ready to get life in prison. And the woman that lost her life, and she was a young woman with a family. People don't understand how that three of the guys wasn't in the car and still getting ready to get a life sentence. And what I try to get them to understand that in the state of Maryland, that it's called a law of participation. If you're there and a commission of a crime happens, that's what's going to happen to you. So what these kids need to understand is that there's consequences for your actions, and you really need to fully understand them before you go out here and do something.
The point there is that there are consequences for who you hang out with.
That's a big consequence. I mean, I'm a Muslim, and the Quran teaches us that you could tell a lot about a person by his closest companion. So meaning that the people that you hang around, that says a lot about who you is and your character. And that was the difference between me and my brother. Me and my brother, actually, we hung around the same dudes. The difference was with us was that he had more self-esteem about himself than I did about me. See, he was secure. My mother say, be home at 12, 11, he pulling me up. We out at the same party. Look, bro, it's time to get ready to go home. Mama say, let's be home. He ain't care about what our buddies thought or said about him. Well, I did. You know, I say, well, I'd rather go home and get this beating that I'm going to get because I'm going to get one. But I much rather deal with her wrath than for my peers to look at me in a certain manner. And that was because of how I felt about myself. Peer pressure and self-esteem and wanting to fit in. Everybody wants to belong.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. From housing and education to healthcare and employment, they will help you fight to make the biggest difference in your community. Join the fight at uwcm.org/fight.
In another email, Carol Klassen wrote, "I can't say enough good things about James. He has been a tremendous blessing in my life. When I feel down, his kind words and humor lift me up. And James is the best Scrabble player I have ever met. I see similar characteristics between James and his Unger friends. I'm impressed by their focused dedication to making positive changes among the youth and helping prisoners. They are extremely well-read, intelligent, and politically active. James is not bitter and appreciates the small, simple things in life. He is truly a great example of the triumph of the human spirit." Over the past 6 years, nearly 200 prisoners, mostly older men convicted of rape and murder, have been set free in Maryland because of the Unger ruling. Researchers for the Justice Policy Institute in Washington found that only one of them has been arrested again, and the JPI is pointing to this as evidence that prison reform could save taxpayers millions of dollars without compromising public safety. The JPI and other groups think Maryland lawmakers should improve the parole process and expand opportunities for the state's oldest prisoners to be released.
We read about the Unger inmates, how they don't cause any trouble. I guess you know that. There's only been one person who had any problem with the law since the Unger inmates were released. I guess that didn't surprise you. You've been with some of those guys, right?
Well, I mean, we work together and we have a close network. What we try to do is try to aid and assist each other in the best that we can to help each other move forward. Now, let me say something about the one dude that went back. First of all, I have a different take on his going back. The guys that came out on the Unger decision, we're fortunate that most of us have family and a support system.
You think it's true for most of the guys, that most of the guys had somebody to go to when they got out?
Yes. You know, yes. The difference was that he was illiterate. And I know this personally because I tried to help teach him how to read while we was in prison. So here was a guy that did 40 years in prison. He's considered out here a functional illiterate. All he ever did in prison was sell drugs and start confusion. So out here, he was a nobody. And there he was important. He went back to the place in which that he's more comfortable at, and he came out here and did the thing, only thing that he knew how to do.
What's the best thing that's happened to you since you got out? And aside from Carol, in your relationship with Carol Klassen, what has made you happy since you've been out?
Wow. My family, being able to engage and be a part of my nephew and my niece's life. And my brother left.
That's the son and daughter of the state trooper brother?
The interactions that I had with people on the street, just the little simple things that people take for granted every day, I value with my life. Like going down here and being able to open up my refrigerator. I'm amazed. People wonder why me living alone, why I got a house instead of a little apartment, because I never had a backyard. I never had a place to call mine.
Or even a little front yard with trash on it and leaves to rake up, right?
Right, right. So, I mean, these are things that I'm blessed and grateful for because, like I say, I know I left a lot of good men, that can make a difference out here in this society. That really the society need that's never going to make it out here again. And not everybody was innocent. Everybody ain't innocent, you know, and I ain't going to sit here and tell you that. But when is enough enough? Most of these guys got at least 40 years in prison. Eventually, they become a burden to the state more than a help because now you're going to geriatric treatment.
There's a prison in Virginia where they have no parole that's basically a geriatric hospital.
Right, and the state of Maryland is a warehouse. It's become, if you have life in the state of Maryland, the only way you're going to get out of prison, if you get a lawyer and get out, if you escape.
You can go for parole. It's up to the governor, though, right? Because the parole commission can recommend you for parole. But for a long time now, because the governor has the power to say no, a lot of guys stayed in prison, even though they were approved for parole. Maryland is only one, last time I checked, of three states that allow the governor to say no. My position has been take it away from the governor. Why do you have a parole commission if a politician, a person who's elected and has to worry about getting reelected, is involved in that?
I agree wholeheartedly, because none is going to. Because if I was a politician, I wouldn't. I mean, that's why you appoint them people to those positions. If you're not going to entrust them in that position, then you shouldn't hire them. I'm telling you, that's one of the things that happened and why the society is the way in which that it is, because all the men got locked up. All the ones that didn't got caught up and strung out on drugs. And this is the result. What you see out here in the streets today are women raising boy children by themselves. You know, this is a big result of that. Oh, one more thing on that point. I'm saying that not only Maryland, but this country, we fighting this thing from the back end of it. Instead of jumping in front, we fighting it from the back.
What do you mean?
I mean, like, we attack things after it happened, not before it started. Now, you had enough incidents to know something needed to be done. My question...
You're talking about getting to kids early in life.
Right? I mean, kids and people, period. You know, I mean, but kids mainly. Why do, you know, the questions you should be asking is why do so many people feel a need to go get a gun to solve their differences now? Where are all these guns coming from? My major push with kids right now is I won't love to get to Florida and talk to them kids that got that gun control movement going.
The Parkland students.
Yeah, the Parkland students, because I believe that they are the ones that's going to be able to change this country. They the next set of voters. They the next set of Democrats, Republicans. They are the ones that's going to be listened to.
By the way, have you voted?
Every chance I get.
You've voted since you got out?
This is my second year of voting. Actually, that's one of the things I'm trying to help get established, is that now that ex-convicts are allowed to vote, I'm trying to get us to form some type of political, you know, to Paul, to let them know that we have a voice now, so that some of these issues that we are concerned about some of the guys that are still in there, that we can get them heard now and make a difference.
Was there a time after you got out when you would wake up in the morning and think you were still in prison?
Wow. The first night, I didn't even go to sleep. I was scared to. You know, I stayed up all night. I sat on the steps of the transitional house all night, right out there on the front, because of that reason, because that I was afraid that it wasn't going to be real, because it had been snatched away from me a couple of times. The day I was supposed to come home on an Unger issue, I done gave away all my property and everything. And the day before I'm supposed to go home, I get a call to go up to the counselor's office, and I'm told that everybody's being released but me. I was afraid to hope.
You had to wait to have a hearing in court? Is that what the delay was?
Well, politics. You know that during the time that I was supposed to have been released, that it was going up for re-election. You know?
So there was some delay there?
Right.
So then you started to worry about whether you were going to get out?
Yes. I mean, because twice before, they have given me dates that was postponed. Yeah. But this one was the day before. They done called my family. All my family excited about that I'm getting ready to come home.
So when did you finally get some good sleep? Start to believe you were actually out?
How long did it take?
Really, to be comfortable, about 2 weeks. And I slept here. And I slept. Sometimes I still, through my day, look at the time of the day and see if I was in prison, what I would be doing at this time. I try not to do that as much, because, like, I had a friend. He died now. He OD'd and died since he been home. I tried to get him some help. I went to some social works people to get him some help, couldn't find him. But he was brilliant. Right now, he could have worked at any IBM company and been the director of it. This high intent, but he could not stop using drugs. Mm-hmm. Nor could he stop. Every conversation we would have would be about prison. Do you remember this? Do you remember that?
Was he an Unger inmate?
No, but he did about 30 years.
Okay. So when he was out and he died from an overdose?
Yes. Yes. And I would tell him that I remember those dudes, I remember those things, but let me tell you what I also remember. I remember that I need to leave that there, because at some point you don't leave it, you're going to go back there. You got to go forward. You know, you got to look forward to it. Like, I have nothing. I don't have nothing. But I am so excited and enthused about my life going forward, because I know I'm going to do some great things out here. I really believe that.
You've been listening to Release, James Featherstone and Life After Life in Prison, episode 447 of the Roughly Speaking podcast, a production of the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks. After a few more episodes, I'll be taking a break from Roughly Speaking to work on other projects for the Sun. In the new year, listen for politics coverage from the Sun's Luke Broadwater and Malia Cromer of Goucher College and the Goucher Poll. Throughout the General Assembly session coming up, they'll be on this podcast to explore the policies, people, and politics of Maryland government. Also, a reminder to listen for The Wait, a podcast series produced by the Sun staff, online now. More information related to today's episode can be found in the show notes. Your reviews and comments are always welcome. And please be sure to support our sponsors. For producers Steve Early and Hallie Miller in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, thanks for listening to the show, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.